This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, did the Gulf Arab states get the cooperation and security guarantees they were seeking from the recent summit meeting with the White House? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. President Obama convened delegations from the Gulf Cooperation Council, or the GCC nations, at Camp David last week to discuss pressing security issues across the Middle East. The summit was foremost an opportunity for the president to make assurances to the Gulf about their security if a nuclear agreement is reached with Iran, but also included discussions about the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen, the continuing Syrian civil war, and the fight against the self-declared Islamic State, also known as ISIL or ISIS. President Obama met with senior ministers from six nations of the Gulf Cooperation Council: Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. Saudi Arabia's King Salman and Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa skipped the summit in what was largely perceived as a snub of the Obama administration. Saudi delegates included Interior Minister Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef and Defense Minister Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. President Obama tried to reassure these skeptical Arab leaders that a potential deal with Iran would not jeopardize their relationship with Washington. He hailed what he called the ironclad U.S. security commitment with the Gulf leaders and insisted he would consider authorizing military force if their countries were threatened by Iran or others. However, President Obama quashed the idea of a NATO-like defense pact advocated by some Gulf diplomats. They want robust security assurances, a formalized defense pact, and powerful weaponry to guarantee their security in the face of an increasingly emboldened Iran. Some analysts say that the joint statement fell short of GCC states' requests and also failed to fulfill the administration's hope that they would embrace the parameters of the emerging deal with Iran. For more on the results of the Gulf Summit and for various perspectives on the outcome, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Alex Vatanka is a scholar at the Middle East Institute. That's a policy group based here in Washington. He's also the author of a forthcoming book, Iran and Pakistan: Security, Diplomacy, and American Influence. And Graham Bannerman. He's a former senior staffer with the State Department Policy Planning Bureau and former staff director of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Graham Bannerman, let me begin with you. As we said, President Obama tried to reassure these skeptical Arab Gulf leaders that this potential deal, and we say potential because it's not been arrived at yet, the potential deal with Iran would not jeopardize their relationship with Washington. Do you think he succeeded?
Well, this is one of those strange diplomatic events where you could not succeed, you could not fail, but it was necessary to have. You couldn't succeed because the gap between the United States and our Gulf allies on the question of Iran and some of the other regional issues is so great, you could not bridge them at this time. You could not fail because the strategic interests of the United States and the Gulf states are so important to each other that they had to succeed. It was necessary to have it, to have a good discussion of these issues, identify the differences, but try to bridge them as much as you could, and I think they did that.
Turning to you, Alex Vatanka, for your perspective regarding the success, failure, or somewhere in between, as Graham Bannerman suggested, of this summit.
Clearly, the Gulf Arabs feel that the United States continues to be on the path of ignoring them. I mean, one could make the argument that's been the Gulf Arab position going back to early 2003 and the invasion of Iraq, which in the eyes of the Gulf Arabs was a strategic mistake because it empowered the Iranians. And now they feel that the Iranians are still winning as a result of either U.S. action or inaction. And when we talk about inaction, they feel that what the U.S. is not doing in Syria is right now the most strategically damaging policy that the U.S. could have from their perspective. So I think, you know, as Graham said, there are a lot of things that they're demanding from the United States. But frankly, I think the Gulf Arab states are failing to take a step back and look at their own policies for a second and always seemingly looking to the United States for a quick solution. And in their eyes, a quick solution is the United States being much more hawkish on Iran, continuing the sanctions and preventing Iran from coming back to the international mainstream, which by and large, I think there is no consensus for in Washington. The consensus in Washington is if the Iranians are willing to make adjustments to the nuclear program, change their behavior both at the home and in the region, then they should have an opportunity to prove their credentials. And I think that's where the gap is.
Turning to you, Graham Bannerman, what Alex just said reminds me of an interesting analogy that I heard lately. Let me bring that to you. We know that there's a tradition of several wives in the Arab world. One can take on several wives. So somebody said recently to me that the Gulf Arabs, perhaps they feel like the first wife on whom the husband is showering many gifts because he's taking on a second wife, and that second wife is Iran. Do you see that analogy to some extent?
No, I don't really. I think they're more worried that they're following the American pattern of the second wife being following the first wife. They're more worried about being excluded. They see the relationship in the Gulf as a zero-sum game. So therefore, any positive movement of the United States towards Iran, even if it's signing a treaty with all sorts of restrictions, somehow diminishes their relationship with the United States. That was the gap the president could not cross. He did the best he could. He said, we're going to give you more equipment. We guarantee we'll come in support. We'll do what we can, but they can't take away that question of if you have a relationship with Iran, it diminishes your relationship with us.
So, Alex Vatanga, do you see that as well? The perception on the part of the Gulf Arabs that this is really a zero-sum game. They can't quite bring themselves to see a potential change in the relationship because as much as the United States says the deal, should it come to pass, does not mean that the United States and Iran will have a rapprochement, so to speak. But nonetheless, it seems as if the Gulf Arabs think that this will follow on. And this, as Graham Bannerman said, appears to threaten them.
I mean, if you travel in the Gulf region, what you hear from many officials among the Gulf Arabs, basically, at least in my mind, falls under borderline conspiracy theories, that there is some sort of a hidden agenda plan here been concocted in Washington where the United States and Iran will look to cooperate in many different arenas against the interest of what the so-called Sunni Arab nation. I don't believe that for a second. But I do at the same time have sympathies for some of the concerns of the Gulf Arab nations. Look, at the heart of this, there is nothing Washington can do about some of the real structural problems that the Gulf Arabs have because of the small size of these countries, by and large, when compared to the Iranians. So if you want to go back 40 years ago, some of the issues that are dividing the Saudis, for example, and the Emiratis existed when the Shah of Iran was there. It's a reflection of the smaller countries fearing a bigger neighbor. Now, obviously, those fears were escalated following the 79 revolution, but the fact is, there is nothing the United States can do about the size of Iran. On the point of what U.S. can do, certainly in the context of the nuclear negotiations, what we've heard in recent weeks from the Saudi side in particular and the Emiratis also is that, look, it seems like and you're going to sign this nuclear deal, but for God's sake, try and get some points, try and get some concessions as part of these talks from the Iranians, which is, look, why don't you push the Iranians a bit more in Syria and what they're doing elsewhere in Yemen and so forth. And the White House, you know, stuck to its initial policy, which is to say, we're not going to bring any other issues into the framework of the talks. We're going to stick to the nuclear agenda. Now, that's what they've done. So I think on that issue, certainly the U.S. administration under the stewardship of President Obama could have been a bit more open to some of the real fears that the Gulf Arab states have about what Iran is doing in the region.
Turning to you, Graham Bannerman, following up on what Alex just said about some of the real fears of the Sunni Gulf states, but I think that there are some legitimate concerns. So let's get to them, especially with regard to Iran's activities in the region, particularly vis-a-vis Syria, supporting Hezbollah, and then the concerns that, should the nuclear deal come to pass, that the sanctions relief could result in a potential windfall for Iran, and that would actually bolster their opportunity to continue these so-called nefarious activities in the region to the detriment of the Gulf Sunni states, to the detriment of their interests.
I think there is legitimate concern that the balance of power in the region is shifting. Clearly in the 1970s, the Shah and Saudi Arabia were the two pillars in which the United States built its policy in the Gulf to protect our mutual interest. With the collapse of Iran and turning into a hostile regime, you've now been through a period of decades where Iran has been the enemy to the United States and to the Gulf states. Now you see the United States saying, we need to work a little bit more with you. That's changing the balance of power. You add into that the change of identity among the population. Now you have increasingly identified by religion. So you add this religious Sunni Shia identity to everything. It compounds a problem that is bad. So they sit there and they say, things are changing, not necessarily in our favor, and we can't rely on the United States. That's why the President of the United States tried to reassure them, we are going to be with you. We will protect your territorial integrity, and we'll supply you with weapons that you didn't think you were going to be able to get in the past. That was the purpose, but it didn't solve their fears.
So, Alex Otanke, it didn't solve their fears, and they certainly don't want to hear about the need for any kind of internal reforms on their part, judging from actions, whether on the part of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, or maybe even the UAE. They're doubling down on, you know, security first. Again, they're concerned about the change of the potential balance of power, should a deal be reached with Iran and any kind of implications thereof.
Well, Kara, on the point of windfall, you talked about, you know, if there's a nuclear deal, what is important to remember is we don't know what's going to happen to that windfall. You know, there's numbers out there between $100 and $150 billion of frozen Iranian assets that in the final deal, should it be reached by 30th of June, might be released. And the fear is, oh my God, this is a blank check to a Iranian regime that will then use the money to go and do whatever it does in the region, just do it on a much larger and more intense scale. I'm not sold on that. I think we have to wait and see. There's a debate in Tehran about what to do with that windfall. So you've got on the one hand the president, his foreign minister Zarif, the president himself, Rouhani, and the so-called moderate faction who believes that, look, the nuclear agreement, if it is reached, is a platform to build on. And if anything, that should give Iran more assurances about its place in the region. And that confidence can be turned into perhaps reaching out to some of the more hardline regional adversaries, particularly Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, in the Iranian debate, you got the hardliners who might just want to use that money to buy arms and to ship it to, you know, their allies in the region. So we have to wait and see. But I think the role of the Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is key on this. And I don't think he's made up his mind in terms of where to go. In his latest speeches on Iran's relations with the United States, he makes it very clear that if we have a good experience with the Americans on the nuclear issue, then we can perhaps repeat this elsewhere in the region. And I think that is a big, big message that's coming from Tehran that we haven't really heard that often in the last 36 years. But look, on the issue of what the Gulf Arabs are looking for, end of the day, it sounded to many of us here in Washington, they wanted a NATO-like alliance. But if you sit and look at that proposition from Washington's vantage point, there just isn't enough common interest and shared values with the Gulf Arab states to create what the U.S. created as post-Second World War in Europe. There just doesn't exist enough common ground. And final point I make, it's very easy to blame everything that's going on in the region in terms of sectarianism on the Iranians. But there is a Sunni Arab extremist side that is also guilty in fueling the fires of sectarianism. And that's where the United States doesn't really have a role to play. Their solution to this is a regional solution. It's a dialogue among the countries that exist in the region. They need to talk about their religious and political differences and not look for the United States, as Graham said, to come in and help them in their zero-sum game strategies. The zero-sum game strategies haven't worked and will not work, and it's only wise that the United States doesn't get itself sort of intertwined into this.
Well, I think you make a very good point, and of course it goes to the importance of some of these states looking within and looking at their own shortcomings. And I think the point about Saudi Arabia being as guilty as Iran in spreading their version of radicalism, whether in the region or even throughout the world, the Wahhabi doctrine, which has been a pretext for some violence, I think that's worth looking at, but of course don't seem to be willing to do so. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Alex Vatanka, he's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, that's a policy group based here in Washington, and Graham Bannerman. He's a former senior Middle East staffer with the State Department Policy Planning Bureau. And we're discussing the aftermath of a high-level meeting between the White House and Gulf state leaders who are deeply concerned about the geopolitical implications of a potential nuclear deal with Iran. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and connect with us on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA. or send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout-out to a new Facebook fan from Liberia, Mariatu Barry.
Well, turning back to you, Graham Bannerman, on whether or not these Gulf Arab states are any more on board with a prospective deal with Iran.
I think they have been resigned to a prospective deal for a while. They're not happy with it. They're not comfortable with it, but they're resigned to that. I mean, so therefore, did we reassure them? No. Did they get a little bit more security out of this? Yes. But I would like to say something. 40 years ago now, I was the Saudi Arabia analyst in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the State Department. I can't tell you how many memos I wrote that spoke about the special relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. It is a very important relationship for both countries, and I would write that same memo today. It is, we have a very special relationship with Saudi Arabia. We're very different countries, and we'll have differences of opinion, but that doesn't mean that relationship isn't special. It should not be forgotten in this.
Quick follow-up, though. Why is it so special? And isn't it relevant to mention that the fact that the United States is now one of the biggest oil exporters in the world, something which was not the case when you were in that position? And doesn't that change the equation?
That's one of the equations I've always disagreed with. It's not a dependence on oil. It's a dependence on stability in the oil market. They're also very important, which they were not then, but they are today, in the financial markets. They and the United States have a great interest in preserving world financial stability. And between the two of us, we have a great ability to work together in both oil market, financial market, which is beyond the security of the region.
Turning to you, Alex Vatanka. So Graham Bannerman says, were he in the position he was several, how many years ago?
40 years.
40 years ago. Well, Alex, if he would be willing to write that same memo, do you agree? Is that special relationship still valid, especially given, okay, Iran, a very large country with a very young population, very pro-American, especially vis-a-vis the Arab states, with lots of potential? Again, I'm not arguing necessarily for any kind of a rapprochement necessarily, but all things being equal, doesn't the United States have, at the end of the day, a lot more in common, at least, you know, philosophically and potentially ideologically, with Iran?
I mean, you could make the argument, I think that's a solid argument, which is the fabric of Iranian society is much more closer to an average American would, you know, be able to understand than the Saudi society. So yes, the Iranian society is much more diverse in terms of its makeup, in terms of also culture and so forth. I agree with that. But I mean, you have a regime in the Islamic Republic of Iran that sits on the top of the pyramid and has yet to decide really which way it wants to go. Stay the course, as they have done since the revolution of 79, or listen to the advice of President Rouhani, who says, look, it's a good time for us to turn a page. And, you know, I don't think the Saudis that I have spoken to never really claim that they share American values. They talk about the strategic interests that the two countries share. And I think, again, to go back to Graham's point, that by and large is true. There is one big exception. And that's the question of fighting Islamic extremism. I don't think Saudi Arabia is playing the role it could be playing in fighting Islamic extremism, certainly in the Sunni world. And I think that is what you increasingly are hearing here in Washington, which is this whole debate about, well, actually, which one is a bigger enemy for the United States, the radical Sunnis or the radical Shias? And increasingly, you know, when you look in the region, the various groups that are operating under the banner of extreme Sunni Islam, that's where American attentions are focused on. And I think that's a real danger for Riyadh.
If I might say something.
Exactly. I'd like to get your view on that. And because we need to remember, with all due respect, that 15 of the 19 hijackers that attacked U.S. soil in 2001 came from Saudi Arabia.
I would agree. I think this is one of the changes that with the new regime in Saudi Arabia in January that has fundamentally altered what people think about the region. What happened was we were reaching a consensus last fall that radical extremism, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, was the biggest threat to all of us. I mean, there was a consensus among Americans and people in the region that that was the enemy. What has happened is the new regime in Saudi Arabia has transformed that discussion to the one we are having today, that Iran is the greatest enemy and it's not really the radical extremism. The Saudis have changed the whole priority of discussion to Iran rather than to radical extremism. And I think in the long run, that's a problem for the United States.
Let's move on to just one more attempt at getting to the heart of the matter, some of the underlying issues between the Gulf Arab states and Iran. I mean, let's face it, Alex Vatanka, there's this Sunni-Shia divide, and if I'm not mistaken, at least the Sunnis in the Gulf states who subscribe to the Wahhabi doctrine, I mean, for them, you know, Shia are anathema. They don't even recognize the Shia sect in Islam, or certainly denigrate it. And I understand that they would rather deal with Jews than Shia Muslims. I mean, this is very serious. So you have that added to the power struggle between Iran and the Saudis. I mean, these are certainly aggravating matters, which also argues for dialogue.
Exactly. Look, before we get to the point of dialogue, let's look at where we are today. I mean, in the Islamic world as a whole, the Shias are 10% of the Muslim population. But in the Middle East itself, the balance is more 50-50. And in my view, the Gulf Arab states, by playing the Sunni card against the Shias, have shot themselves in the foot. They've turned a large portion of the Arab world, who happens to be Shia, a majority in Iraq, a majority in Bahrain, about half of the population in Yemen, and so forth, and they've turned them into Iranian agents by pursuing a policy that says, if you're not my kind of Sunni, then you're not a real Muslim. Therefore, there are groups like the Islamic State who are basically more than willing to chop heads of people that they don't consider to be proper Muslims. This is a strategic mistake that the Gulf Arab states have been pursuing from the day the United States removed Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And as I said, they turned Arabs into Iranian proxies when that didn't necessarily have to be the case. They could have played a different card. Iranian nationalism could have been turned into the big enemy. But they turned to the religious label, and that, as I said, has undermined their own position. And it's not one that the United States is willing to, you know, be party to. There are all sorts of conspiracies in the Islamic world about how the U.S. is behind this Shia-Sunni divide. Or Israelis, in some arguments that, you know, you read, are behind this Shia-Sunni divide. I mean, it's ludicrous. Mm-hmm. Where was the United States or Israel 1,400 years ago when Islam came to be? So, again, the dialogue is one that they need to have among themselves in the region. When I was reading Iranian newspapers this morning, the Friday prayer in Tehran was saying the House of Saud has to come down. And the same kind of message has been expressed in Riyadh, I'm sure, about how the Islamic Republic is the biggest evil that exists. This is the narrative that's wrong. This is the narrative that, backed by oil money, results in young unemployed men in the Middle East then going out there and killing one another. I mean, how long can this go on for? And, you know, the idea that the United States wants to get involved in this, again, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, you have to give President Obama credit. People say he's got no leadership in the Middle East. But on this issue, what can he do? But there are areas where you can ask. You can ask the Saudis and the Iranians again to take a step back. And I think Yemen is a great example. Neither Saudi Arabia or Iran can afford to get involved too deeply in Yemen. And the U.S. can play the role of saying, look, here's a good starting point. Let's not start with the hard ones like Syria. Let's take something where you both want to get out as soon as you can. And that Yemen is that example. So let's see. I mean, if the United States can provide leadership and provide the kind of political setting where they can start talking to one another, maybe soon enough they can get to those really hard disputes like the Shia-Sunni divide, which, by the way, is being exploited by politicians. I mean, you've always had the divide among religious folks in the seminaries, in the mosques, and so on. But now it's come to impact everyone. Again, as Graham said, people now, you know, labeling themselves not whether they're Arab or Iranian or Turk, but whether they're Sunni and Shia. And that's the tragedy of the Middle East today.
Turning to you briefly, Graham Bannerman, for a reply, notwithstanding the power struggle between Iran and Saudi Arabia and the Arab Gulf states, do you see a political will in trying to tackle this Sunni-Shia divide by dialogue, or is it just has been exacerbated and will continue to be exploited?
It's hard to see at this time how there's going to be a dialogue. They're not even on the same page. That said, not all conflicts in the region are the same. And I agree totally that Yemen is the perfect example. There is a Yemeni nationalism that you'd never heard of the divide in Yemen until recently, but it was the outsiders who tended to make it happen. I like to point out to say that from 897 to 2012, you always had a Zaydi leader of Yemen.
And Zaydis are more affiliated with the Shia.
They are one of the subsets of Shiism, but they never have been closely aligned with Iran because they have major differences there. So they were a subset. They had been the leaders of this country, this geographical area, for a long time. Then in 2012, you end up with a Sunni leader who was supposed to be a transition. Then you have this revolt of Yemenis who, and they started first of being just Houthis in the north. They expanded to the Zaydi community, and now they have many Sunni supporters too. So they're Yemenis by identity, and the Yemenis don't like the Saudis.
Okay, briefly, do you see a possibility on Yemen where the two sides, that is Saudi Arabia and Iran, perhaps could find common ground? And I believe in a previous program you talked about Oman being a potential bridge and a mediator. Oman, because Oman is a little bit different from the other Gulf Arab states. It has been a bridge between the United States and Iran, and it doesn't always go along with the GCC anti-Iranian narrative.
Well, the Omanis are different from the other Gulf states in that they're not Sunnis and they're not Shias. They're Abadis. They're separate. So therefore, they find themselves sitting aside. They did not support the coalition. Therefore, they are a potential platform for this discussion. But what's important is that already some of the supporters of Saudi Arabia in Yemen have said, wait a second, we are having trouble with the idea that our allies in Yemen are Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood affiliates. Therefore, that's a problem. I think the Saudis are beginning to say, we're not going to solve this through military means. We're going to have a negotiated thing. Unfortunately, if you read the statement that came out from the summit on Yemen, they said the United States supported the Gulf states in having the Riyadh conference to be the way this thing is resolved. It's not going to get resolved in Riyadh. Riyadh has now moved itself to a participant in the struggle, so therefore it's not a legitimate venue for solving it.
We'll talk about Yemen in another program, but as we close, so back to you, Alex Vatanka. What about the fact that Saudi Arabia and some other smaller Arab states are now talking about vowing to match whatever nuclear enrichment capability Iran would be permitted to retain should this deal go through? And could this deal then perversely spur an arms race in the region?
You know, that's always been the fear. The question is, will they implement their own slogans? I mean, the Saudis have been saying this for over a year now. Whatever deal the U.S. signs with Iran, Saudi Arabia wants exactly the same. Whether the Saudis have the indigenous capacity to put together a nuclear program the way the Iranians have done is a big question mark. And the other thing is, whether others, the Koreans, the French, others might be willing to supply them is also a question mark, and how much the U.S. will oppose such a trend is also a question mark. So as you can hear, I got a lot of question marks here. You know, what the headline out of that pledge by the Saudis and the Gulfies is how much they dislike the fact that the U.S. has, after, you know, about 12, 13 years of talking to the Iranians, basically decided to meet Iran, not halfway, but closer to the Iranian position. So there you have it. But end of the day, it comes down to how does the Gulf Arab states and Iran make one another stakeholders in one another's well-being and go away from the zero-sum game? Again, quick analogy. I grew up in Europe. Europe has not experienced war since Second World War, because they started with small steps where they created what today is the European Union. It's taken decades to get where we are. It's not perfect, as Greece will show, but they made one another stakeholders, and you haven't experienced war. How does the Middle East, inclusive Iran, the Arab world, Israel, all get along and make one another stakeholders? That's what you want to see, and unfortunately, that's not the conversation we're having today.
I think we have to send Alex Vatanka as a special envoy to achieve that. Well, the last word to you, Graham Bannerman, with respect to this, the fact that this potential nuclear deal might spur an arms race in the region, given Saudi Arabia's statement that it may want to match whatever nuclear enrichment capability Iran is permitted to have.
The goal would be not to have an arms race, but that doesn't mean denying peaceful nuclear capacity to anybody in the region. I mean, under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, countries are allowed to have the ability to have a nuclear energy industry. Denying it to the region is a problem. It would be a problem to keep the Arabs from doing it. It would be a problem to keep the Iranians from doing it. That's what the agreement with Iran is trying to do, eliminate the military aspect of it while allowing them to keep the civilian aspect, which is proved under international law.
Whatever one thinks of the potential Iranian deal, it's certainly opening up lots of Pandora's boxes in the region. So to be continued. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Alex Vatanka. He's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, and Graham Bannerman, former senior Middle East staffer with the State Department Policy Planning Bureau. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Brian Marcoulier. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.